Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to say thank you to you for taking your time, energy, and above all other things, your willingness to sit down and listen to these podcasts. On today's episode, I had the pleasure to go Canadian again. I interviewed Marie Weiss, CEO of Copilot Marketing and a book author of an outstanding book, You Can't Be Everywhere. Marie is just a lovely gal, and you know, I'm writing a blog post this week, and what the blog post is really about is the premise of crucibles. And a crucible is basically a moment in time where you go through some sort of difficult situation, whether it's personal or professional. And so many of these podcasts, you find these executives who've had crucibles, and Marie is no different. So have a listen, pick out our crucible, let me know if you hear it when this thing goes up. Want to say thank you, as always, to my content partner, C-Suite Radio, Engage Me Online Magazine, Transformation Radio, and Thrive Global. All right, everyone. As always, hit the iTunes, hit the Overcast.fm, hit the SoundCloud, review it anywhere and everywhere. Have a great week. See you. Marie, can you just quickly give my audience just a quick 10,000-foot view of who you are and what you do?
Who I am and what I do. Okay, so...
I've never had anyone have to pause and think about those two questions, so...
Well, I just, you know, I don't feel old, but I forget that I've been in the marketing business for a long time. Wow. I've been at it for close to 30 years. Wow. And... primarily helping businesses who sell to other businesses figure out the best way to attract and engage their audience. And I started out working for nonprofits. I then went to work in government for a bit and then wound up in financial services, which is a tough gig for a marketer because there's nothing more complicated and quite frankly boring to try to market than financial services products. And so that was a really good, oh, and I also spent some time with the CPA profession and marketing accounting standards, which again, complex, tricky, and it taught me some lessons about communicating using real language, helping people understand something from their perspective, not from yours. And so when I started my own business I started consulting in 2003, but really launched my business in 2006. I was very dedicated now at this point of having learned all these things over the years about helping people sell complex products and services in a way that mattered to the customer, not mattered to the product or service. And I really wanted to dig into that. So I've really spent the last 10 years researching in and around the ideas of value proposition. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing more compelling these days, in my opinion, as a marketer, than to have the opportunity to test value proposition in the marketplace based on a landing page or a website or, quite frankly, a 140-character tweet, where you are able to test your value proposition almost on a daily basis to see who cares. And to me, the definition of digital marketing, which I've been doing now for a while, is testing your value proposition to see who it resonates with and if those people can become engaged in your company through either buying.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead. Well, I don't know.
I was just going to ask. It sounds almost like you do. I don't know if this is true or not, but it sounds like you almost do live A/B testing.
We try to do that if you wanted to get technical with it, but we, you know, and obviously we work a lot with small and medium sized businesses. They struggle very much with this because they often don't have the time, money, and resources to do this the way a big company would do it. But when you think about it, you're testing it everywhere you go and in everything you do today as a business. So you might be at a networking breakfast and you're standing up explaining what your company does. If you're not doing that in a compelling way, and then after the person has heard from you at the breakfast and goes back and looks at your website and lands on the homepage, and if that isn't a consistent story and message, and then they take another click and realize, oh, I don't know what this company does, and they're gone, you've lost all that goodwill of starting to engage people. So yeah, specific A/B testing will happen in your email marketing and your landing pages, but it's really getting down to figuring out the best positioning for a company, being able to describe that, and then able to use content to engage people. And that's really what we've been doing for the last, I would say, 10 years.
So I want to dive into that a little bit later. You know, one of the premises, and I might always make the assumption that my poor guests never really know what they're in for because they haven't listened to another podcast before this. So maybe I shouldn't assume. Have you listened to a podcast before this?
Yes. Yeah.
I've been heavily
immersed in the podcast world. I think they're fantastic and I'm loving them as a format and a medium. And so when people send me links, I always go check them out and find out what other, and I'm always hugely impressed by what other people have to say.
That's awesome. So just to clarify, I need to put this in quotes and put it on my website as my value proposition. You actually listen to one of my podcasts.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes, that
right
would
no
be
more,
very
no more.
Good.
That's perfect. So you have.
Okay.
So as you know, I like to dive in a little bit about where you're from. So are you originally from Toronto?
I grew up just an hour north of Toronto until I was 19. And then I went back to Toronto to go to university and lived there for quite a while. And I've just recently moved back. So I've come back to my hometown and I can't make a move in my hometown without running into somebody I know or probably went to high school with. So it's been an interesting, juxtaposition.
What's your hometown? Not that the small tiny one?
Town. And well, a town just north of Toronto called Barrie, Ontario. That's where I grew up, and I've moved back here. A lot of my family is still here, and it's been interesting. I just purchased a house here in a neighborhood and showed up at the door to do the house tour, and the guy who answered the door was selling the house on behalf of his parents. I'd gone to high school with him, and I thought, oh gosh, I hope he's not going to hold this against me. But he sold me the house anyway, so it was good.
Well, that also means you were memorable, so that works out well as well.
Yeah, but you know, memorable could go both ways, yeah. Right?
That's so true, man. I don't want to run into anybody that I know in the past. So I think Toronto, by the way, is such an amazing city. I was last there probably 5 years ago before my grandma died, and I hadn't been there really as an adult, right? I'd been there as a child, and I just find the city so amazing. I mean, cost-wise, it's ridiculous. And travel-wise, in terms of commute, is ridiculous as well. But it's just a beautiful city with a beautiful soul, don't you think?
Yes, and I've been a big fan of Toronto for a long time, having lived there for close to 20 years and living in a particularly great part of the city called the Beaches, which is down on the water. And it's like a little town within a big city, and I always loved it. It was a great place to live. It was a great place to raise your kids. It has a very nice community vibe to it. And then there's parts of the city that are very culturally diverse, and Toronto's really changing right now. Toronto is going through a big overhaul with all the building that's going on, and yes, the traffic is just awful. The province and the city didn't keep up with the infrastructure and making sure that transit and everything else was up to speed. So now we're really dealing with that in a big way.
Is it changing for the good or for the bad?
I have to pause and think about that. My son is living pretty much not very far from where we lived for a long time. He's gone back because he's going to school down there. And I go to visit him and I see the neighborhood and I still think it's a great neighborhood. And I've got lots of friends who are there. And I think it's changing. It's too early to tell whether it's good or bad. I will always call it Toronto the good, no matter what you say to me and no matter what you ask. It is always Toronto the good. There's been, I think it's just getting very congested, very crowded. It tries to be a bit of a mini New York City, yes, in a lot of ways, which I love New York. I'm a big fan of New York. But the verdict's too soon to tell. Yeah, there's a lot of foreign investment going on right now in Toronto, a lot of foreign investment where people see it as a safe haven and a harbor but don't necessarily want to invest in being there and building the community. They're just buying up stuff. Yeah. And I think that's going to hurt us because it takes people to build a city, not just money. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the things we'll have to pay attention to.
So one of the things I was thinking about as well is because you had mentioned early on before I started recording that your daughter is an athlete. And so were you an athlete growing up as well?
I tried. No, I played a ton of sports, and I would have to say basketball was my passion as well. But because I grew up in this town, North Toronto, and because we love our snow in Canada so much, it gave me the opportunity to do a ton of stuff as a kid. Like our public school that I went to was such a tiny public school that we didn't have a gym. So we were shuttled all over the place to get the equivalent of what would be gym time. So I grew up downhill skiing, skating, playing hockey. We in Ontario, we had a premier years ago who insisted that swimming be part of the school curriculum because we have so much fresh water and lakes in Ontario that he felt it was really important for kids to learn how to swim, which I think is fantastic.
It's a good life skill too.
Absolutely. And so swimming, did a lot of swimming and then played a lot of basketball, volleyball, and then sports were a big part of my life.
So I have to give a confession. As a child, having a mom that was from Toronto, that meant that I had to love the Blue Jays. And I, at one point, and I remember coming back from college, seeing this, thinking, wow, how sad. My walls, three of the four, because one had a closet along it, or a window along it, had Toronto Blue Jays paraphernalia, like from the ceiling to probably 4 feet off the floor. And I'm talking shirts in frames, pennants in frames, boxers on the wall, socks hanging on the wall, the 1992 team in the trading, like top hats or top whatever, tops cards on the wall, bumper stickers, license plate frames, a baseball with John Paularu's signature on it. Like my whole room threw up Toronto Blue Jay.
So, well done. Yeah. Well done. I'm glad to hear you reference the 92 and the glory years.
Yes,
we're still trying to get it back a bit here, but baseball was a tough sell back in the day. It was a very tough sell up here in Canada. A lot of people did it, for fun on the weekends, but the Blue Jays really turned Canadians on to baseball. And now we had something to do other than hockey. So
the
I
Raptors
was always grateful
the
to the Blue Jays. Oh, the Raptors are fantastic. I love them. So, yeah. Yeah. Right. So it's great.
So I'm probably going to lose half my audience just talking about Canadian sports. So, so you're growing up in this little northern town of Canada, how big is the town?
We're now 130,000, but when my parents first moved here, it was probably 20,000.
Wow.
So, yeah. So pretty small.
So you couldn't even fart without someone knowing what happened in that town.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You really had to keep your nose clean.
So did you have brothers and sisters that you got in trouble with?
Well, I have a sort of an odd family dynamic from the perspective that my sisters are quite a bit younger than me. They're 10 and 11 years younger than me. So I kind of grew up looking after my sisters, which meant that that kept me out of trouble. Yeah. So between playing sports most of the time and looking after my sisters, I managed, although I shouldn't say that, I still got in a lot of trouble. But it was, it was good. But I have to say it made me very anxious and eager to leave when I graduated from high school and go do other things. So you kind of want to get out for a while.
What was the gap there, can I ask?
Yes, I think you and I have chatted about this. I felt that it wasn't culturally diverse enough for me as a town, and I wanted to see the world. And meet.
What I was talking about was the gap between you and your sisters.
Oh, why was there such a gap? Yeah. Oh, my mother passed away when I was young, and my dad remarried, and so by the time he remarried and had kids, there was a huge gap between us. So, great for me, and my sisters are a huge part of my life, and it was very good that happened. But that's why. And the blessing of all of that is that I spent every summer with my grandparents, who were my real mother's parents. So as a result of them losing their daughter, they felt it was very important to have me every summer with them. And when you said in your email to me and asked me about who I admired, my grandmother was a huge part of my life and probably the biggest influence in my life. And I spent 3 or 4 summers traveling right across Canada with her in a camper van. And so I got to see, every nook and cranny of Canada all because of my grandmother. So, that was very, very big part of my life. And I was very fortunate.
Well, yeah. What a special time. I remember, you know, my mom and dad, we didn't do a lot. I grew up like a lower middle class. And when I say low, I mean, maybe $1 above the poverty line, middle class at that time. And I just remember the 2 trips my dad and I took someplace to see my grandparents and how it was etched in my mind. So I can only imagine like spending that much time with your grandma. And probably for you, did you feel like that was the closest connection to your mom that you're going to get?
Absolutely. And the fact my mom left behind 2 sisters, and she was the middle child and had an older sister and a younger sister. And I spent a lot of time with my aunts as well. And all because it was a very, very important connection for me to my mother. And my mother and her whole family were French Canadian. And I don't know if you know anything about French Canada, but it's a very different culture as well. And it's very much about family, and it's very much about food. And it's a lot about eating and drinking and laughing. And that was a big part of being with them. That's what it was always about.
So I was really curious about just your mom's death. And how old were you when that happened? Because clearly you have these women around your mom, her sisters and her mom, who put you underneath their wings. And I guess what I'm curious about is how did that influence you through your teenage years as you are matriculating through? And did that have an impact with your stepmom?
It's interesting you're asking me this. Yeah, I am. My mother died in a car accident when I was 5 years old, and I was actually in the car at the time, and my brother didn't survive the accident, neither did my mother, and her youngest sister was in the car, and she and I survived. And that's a lot of tragedy for a family to absorb. And it's certainly a lot of tragedy for my father to absorb in his life. And so he wanted to get married again quite quickly because he wanted to sort of get his family back together. After my mother died, I went to live with my grandmother for 2 years because my father was really struggling to get his life back on track. And so I lived with my grandmother, and my dad just didn't feel he could. Mm-hmm. He was just starting out as a teacher. He made a career for himself as a teacher and coached a lot of sports, and he was just trying to get it all back together. So he met somebody and got married, and she did the best thing she possibly could, which was to make my mother's family a big part of their life. And so she loved the fact that I went and spent every summer with them, and they were invited to everything when I was growing up. Obviously a lot of events. I was also a singer in a choir, and so they were always getting invited to everything. And that was a big, that was a really, really important thing.
I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
You hear the other side of that story all the time, where because of the individual's jealous streak, essentially, they create a wedge. So,
yeah.
So how did that, obviously at five, it's probably tough to wrestle with that from an emotional standpoint. But as you're growing older, like, what was the influence of your, because I feel like maybe there was no overwhelming influence because you had support all around you. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I've often thought about that. But I firmly believe I would not be the person I am today had I not had that in my life. And because there is always that sadness and darkness that hangs over you. And I think it's more impactful for women, and I could be wrong, I think it's more impactful for women than it is for men, because the mother role is such an important role in your life. And it really hit me hard. So I probably grew up as a very average kid until I had my first child, and that's when it really hit me hard. And it hit me hard on three fronts. It hit me hard from the perspective that I was trying to start my own career, and I was grappling with this whole working mom thing that was still evolving at the time that I was doing it. And I was trying to get my...
How did you come to terms with that?
I don't know that I did, from the perspective that I probably made a lot of mistakes. There's probably a lot of things I probably didn't do terribly well because I was working so hard all the time. And I probably missed out on some stuff early on in my kids' lives because I worked so much and was so ambitious in the jobs that I had. And
I think where that came from, because I feel like that's a whole other issue, right? So like, you struggle with this identity of mother, career woman, and yeah, you have this ambition. So my wife, she has a job, but her passion is raising the kids. And so, she would totally struggle if she had to work, for sure. I don't know if she could.
For a long time, I blamed it on the fact that I spent so much time looking after my younger sisters that I had this sort of feeling in my gut, like, oh, I don't want to have to get married and have children because it's too much work. And I really wanted to make a career for myself, and I really wanted to be successful at what I'd set my mind to. And I think it was that. And then I got pregnant with my first child by accident. It wasn't planned, and it was kind of thrust upon me. And I struggled with it after she was born, about going back to work. I'd been offered a really great job about 3 months after she was born. And at that time in Canada, you could stay home for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, either take another 3 months and enjoy her as a baby, or I get this job, which is kind of being offered to me, and I got to get going. So I chose to do that. And the silver lining in that is that my kids went to a home daycare where we met the most phenomenal families and are friends with them still to this day. And my kids are still friends with a lot of them, the kids in the daycare. Mm-hmm. So that turned out to be great. That doesn't always happen. And it doesn't always turn out when you outsource your child rearing, your child care, that you get that opportunity. And so I think I struggled with feeling guilty that I wanted to work and feeling guilty that I wanted a career. And at the time when I was going through a lot of that, I think that's when a dark cloud was kind of settling in, recognizing that the loss of my mother had probably influenced me a lot more than I realized.
You know what's funny? And there's a friend of mine who, very similar to you, she ended up having to raise her siblings a lot. Like, basically her mom just outsourced to her to do it. And she, after conversations, she started working. She had her two kids. And after the second one was probably two, she started working full time and working incredibly hard. like long hours traveling. And she said the same thing. She said, you know, I just felt like as a kid, as a young adult, I lost my option to work. And she felt like she was stuck at home a lot as a teenager and couldn't do the same fun things as her friends. And essentially she was forced to grow up faster than she wanted at the end of the day. Mm-hmm.
And I think that might've been a little bit of me, but fortunately for me, I ended up meeting and marrying someone who did not share. And there was times when this would annoy the heck out of me, but did not share my ambitions from a career perspective. And so when our youngest daughter was born, I have three kids. And when our youngest daughter was born and I was going through some health problems, I asked him, would you stay home for a year? Because now at this time in Canada, maternity leave or paternity leave was a year. And so he went to his boss, who was a woman, who said, I'm going to take a year off to stay home with the baby and the kids. And she's like, you're what? And she was shocked. And so then we had to deal with the whole other set of issues, which is stay-at-home dads don't get a lot of respect. They do things very differently than stay-at-home moms. And we had a lot of gender identity things that ended up happening. And
like
our kids
That's
were always...
Like, tell me like
Well, you know, I was always expecting them, especially since we lived in this great neighborhood down in Toronto where the moms groups were very, very powerful, influential groups. And I always expected him to be out having coffee with them. But no, the moms don't let the dads in, yeah. You know, because they're talking about women's stuff. And on the other hand, he wasn't terribly interested. Like, yeah, he'll volunteer for hot dog day when he has to, but he's not terribly interested in he just kind of did his own thing. And that kind of made me nuts because at the time I thought he wasn't integrating as well as he should have been. But in the end, he just found his own path and it turned out to be very successful for him. So,
and are you two still married?
Yeah, we've been married now for 26 years. So
that's awesome.
He's been my biggest fan and supporter in starting my own business at a time when it was very scary because he didn't have a full time income, and he's always just said, "Do it, go for it," and has always been very, very supportive.
I'm so convinced that, you know, this is my projection. Is that, you know, when you have couples who are very similar in every way, it actually ends up bad. But when you have a yin and yang, you know, so I'm the total go get it, take the risk, throw the money out the window and figure it out. My wife is like, whoa, pull the reins back and neuter that horse. Right. So like,
Well, if you're like us though, like, and we went through a very hectic time when our first two kids were young because he was working, I was working. There was a lot of fighting always going on about who was picking up the kids at daycare, who was staying home. I was traveling a lot. So by default, it landed in his lap. And I always say, and this is a very sexist comment, that men sometimes have a hard time multitasking. He will admit he's a unitasker. Give me one thing and I'll do it really well, but don't make me do two or three things at the same time. So working and looking after kids and trying to take care of a house, he found it very stressful. So just let me take care of the kids and look after the house and you go make the money. But it takes a while to sort through those things. And while it is important for you to be very different, sometimes though, being too different means you struggle to sort things out.
Oh,
and
sure,
I know
sure.
We fumbled around a lot in the beginning and then we finally sort of found our groove. And he was only supposed to be home for a year. He was only supposed to take a year off. And at the end of the year, I said to him, it's on you now, because our daycare had evolved and changed. I said, it's on you now to go find a daycare or interview nannies and sort out the child care so you can go back to work. And I was getting very mad at him because he wasn't making enough phone calls. And I came home one day and he said, well, I made one phone call and it sorted out. And I said, oh, okay, what was the phone call? He says, I called my boss and quit. And I said, well, that wasn't the phone call you were supposed to make.
I bet the fly on that wall that day had an interesting ear of what was said.
Yeah. It was, and you know, and then what was interesting, he was working as a controller for in a brokerage firm, and it was right when a lot of regulations were changing in the financial services industry. So they wanted him to come back and train him as the compliance officer. And he had a great opportunity at that company, and they even called him 2 years later and said, will you come back? And he hemmed and hawed, and just for lots of reasons, it didn't make sense. So he still said no, which kind of, he took himself out of the career force at that point, you know, or the career market at that point by saying no to that. And so he had made a decision, no, I'm really good at managing the kids. And he had, you know, we have three kids who were very active, very involved, played a lot of sports, did a lot of stuff. And so that he just loved that. And that's what he ended up being really successful at.
And do your kids have good, strong relationships with him?
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. Like, they all have very different relationships with him, but the youngest one in particular, they're just like best buddies. And because she's been with him since she was 2 months old.
And so he's right? like a little bit of a jealousy sometimes, like not like a malicious jealousy, but like, you know, like tonight, my daughter said, I love you to my wife, say goodnight. And I'm sitting right there. I'm like, I love you. And she just walked out of the room. I was like, come on, a little love, like a little bit. So, you know what I mean? Like, I'm a little jealous. My wife has that relationship with her because he's around her all the time.
I think it's great for them. I have great relationships with the other two as well. I have a different relationships with all three of them. I don't get jealous because I think she needs that in her life right now. And she's traveling all over the place playing basketball, and he's like the key driver, and they spend hours and hours together, and it just works. She and I are too similar. Yeah. And after a few hours, we get on each other's nerves. And so it works that she travels with her dad, and I'm happy for it.
So there's a couple of questions, and I want to transition to my fast five, which is five random questions. And then we're going to talk about your book after that. You can't be everywhere. So we'll talk about that the second half of the podcast. So just to kind of jump up a little bit here in the podcast, tell me about this process of your career, right? So we've already talked about how you struggle a little bit as being a career mom, basically a mom and a career woman. But as you're moving up in these different organizations, you know, did you find yourself still wanting that drive to succeed? Or did you find yourself ever feeling comfortable? Like, you know, like what was your, I guess essentially, what was your drive?
That's an interesting question. I don't know that a lot of people ask me that question, and I'm not sure that I really know, other than whenever I start feeling comfortable and it starts feeling repetitive, that's when I figure we have to blow it up and do something else. And I have had some great jobs throughout my life. I've had some really fantastic opportunities that people gave me because I was a bit of a go-getter, and they would give me responsibility when, quite frankly, I probably wasn't ready for it and probably didn't deserve it, but they gave it to me anyways and made me step up. The one thing I have learned about myself over the years is that I am a doer, and I hate it when I don't see progress getting made. And that's a pro and a con to that. There's a con to that as well. And so when I was working for one of the big banks in Canada, which was actually owned a bank in Chicago as well, and I was commuting back and forth between Toronto and Chicago, working in the corporate banking side of this company, I was now the first time ever responsible for a large team of people. And I had probably about 10 people reporting to me, and I look back on it now and realize I was brutal at it. And it was because I was so busy wanting to see stuff getting done that I wasn't managing and coaching people, which was really the job I should have been doing. And so when I got asked to go to a software firm that was kind of on the rise and they were filling out their executive, it seemed exciting for me because I was going to be allowed to do stuff. And I always like to do stuff, but I'm now learning about my career and about myself, that there's a time for doing and then there's a time for really thinking. Mm-hmm. And there's a time for managing and coaching. And so as my career evolved, I was fortunate to learn a lot about myself and what I thought I would be good at. And that's why I was always gravitating towards wanting to start my own business, because I thought I had the, makeup for it. And I'm still learning that it's still about managing people and sure. coaching people, and whether it's your clients, whether it's people who work for you, whether it's suppliers, whatever, like that is the most important thing that you can probably learn early in your career. And the faster you learn that, the better.
Because I mean, it would seem to me that you're also a little bit of like this. That would, let me ask, like, were you driven like this as a kid, or were you control freak's the right word, but did you like to control the situations and like that's kind of manifested itself? Because usually when you're doers, you know, at least what I find is that I have an idea in my head and I know, and I feel like I'm the only one that can get it done in a timely manner. So I just get annoyed if someone gets in my way or they don't do it my way.
Yes, I think I've got a little bit of that in me. I think you've articulated it well. I do think I have that in me. I also think even at a young age, I was very competitive. Mm-hmm. And there is a real competitive streak that runs through my dad's side of the family. They were all athletes and very competitive. You can't even, God help you if you even played euchre with them on a Saturday night. And so, you know, there's a competitive streak of I want to win, I want to succeed. I think there's a little bit of that in me.
That's awesome. So just talking about your company really quick, you know, you have this company that I totally dropped the website down. I apologize. It's something.
Marketing Co-Pilot. MarketingCo-Pilot.com. Yeah.
Yeah. And so tell me like what the challenge is for you as a person trying to run this company. Because, you know, I don't want to, this is like a sexist question, right? But you probably dealt with it. It's like you're a woman of a very successful marketing company that, you know, I imagine there are stereotypes that you maybe deal with. And I don't know, but are there?
Well, no, it's funny you say that, because we were just doing a customer scorecard for our own company and a buyer persona and everything. And we realized that in the business-to-business verticals that we sell into and the types of companies we work for, it's always men over the age of 45 who we're dealing with, who are either VPs of sales or CEOs of the company. And they have a bias about marketing first and foremost, maybe not so much about women, but definitely a bias about marketing. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of women in marketing. And so you have to overcome that. And there's definitely things you're overcoming.
What do you do to overcome it? Like, what do you say or act or?
Well, we've tried very hard to take the teaching approach, and we try very hard to teach and show. But when I started this company, I started it because I had been a vice president of sales and marketing in large companies and smaller companies. And I was frustrated with the way that people sold marketing services. And there was a real shift going on in the market when I started, because you were starting to see these very specific point solutions coming about, like AdWords and SEO and email marketing. And I was frustrated because you were either buying a tactic or you were buying creative, or you were spending big bucks on a consultant who would tell you something and then not help you implement it. So I wanted to create a very different type of solution based on a methodology and a framework. And so that hardest thing I've had to deal with is in building a company is figuring out how to deliver the service in a way that's unique and different, and not just, oh, we sell SEO or, oh, we do websites. And so having to learn and educate and continually learn about how that applies to our framework and our methodology is the thing that probably exhausts me the most, but is probably the best part of the business.
Well, since one of the major things that you guys hang your hat on is really teaching organizations to create their unique selling proposition on the landing page, I guess what would be your unique selling proposition as an organization?
I would say it's two things. First of all, it's evidence-based marketing. We use data and information to make informed marketing decisions. We don't just guess, and we're not just trying to sell creative or say, oh, here, you should make it pretty and do this. We're digging into data to figure out how people are engaging with a company and a business. So the fact that we use that data and our methodology is wrapped around that, I think, is very unique. And there's not a lot of companies we see doing that. And the second thing is we help companies turn their web presence into their best sales tool. And I think that people will say they do that, but the way you go about doing it to really dig down to figure out how do I engage with a customer in their language and the way they need to consume information in the buyer journey is something that other people are starting to pick up on. But we've been in the marketplace talking about that for close to 10 years now. And, you know, it's just lucky for me that everybody now is talking about changed buyer behavior and how people self-serve and self-educate and do all these things now in the buying process that they never did before. And I remember up here in Canada going to talk to CEOs. I was the first female chair of a big tech association up here in Toronto. And I would go talk to these CEOs of tech companies and I would say, how is your website helping you in the sales process? And they go, oh, nobody ever comes to our website. Nobody ever looks at our website before they buy from us. It's all referrals, word of mouth. We call people. This was 2010, 2011. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, I would say 8 out of 10 CEOs I talked to thought that their website was inconsequential. Mm-hmm. And I kept speaking and I kept putting on workshops and I kept talking to people and I kept at it. And finally, I would say kind of 2012, we started to see it tip. And people would say, you know, I just lost a deal because the prospect went to our website and we haven't updated it in 5 years and it looks like hell and it's terrible content and it was terrible to navigate. And then what really spurred the whole thing along was Google's shift to mobile and people wanting mobile responsive websites and content. And then people really started to take a hard look at it. What am I doing? Should I be making this better? And so it helped our story, but this is the story we've been talking about since probably 2008.
So, you know, as like I have a consulting business on the side among my 27 hats. But I'm curious because, you know, with the advent of companies like Wix.com or Square, you know, for a small entrepreneur, are those websites sufficient enough to drive traffic?
No. And I think they're great. Yeah, no, I'm just going to come right out and say no. I think they're a great first step for people who are trying to get a website up and wanting to get some data going and they want to see it. But your website needs to be a living entity in your business, almost the same way a salesperson is. And you need to treat it that way. And so you can't just buy something off the shelf. You need to create a infrastructure in your website. And I've looked at Wix. I've got people who've used Squarespace and other stuff, and it only will take you so far. You can't customize the blog. You can't create landing pages the way you need to. The data in the back end that you can look at is limited. Yeah. You can't set up a bunch of stuff that you need to mine the data. You can't put marketing automation products on it. So it'll take you a certain way, and if you're just dipping your toe in, then yeah, get one set up and get going because you'll learn a lot from that experience. But that will give you a very limited experience. And I find that most people who use those tools are doing it because it's cheap and they need to get started, and that's great. But if your business really starts to grow and evolve, you need to view your website like you would a salesperson in your company.
That's really good advice, by the way. Because, you know, I've had probably a website for 4 years now, and if you were to Google it, I get a lot of traffic. If you Google just the website, it'll come up top of the first page, but it hasn't really driven anything. And there could be, I mean, a whole slew of reasons why, you know, the content's relevant, but I don't have a chance to update it a lot. And now we're in a content-driven world. So, you know, if you're not constantly updating your content, but I guess what do you say to someone who is a small company of 10 or 15 people where that's almost like a full-time job to create strong content?
What I say to people, and I work as an executive in residence at a place called the Innovation Factory, which is just southwest of Toronto in a city called Hamilton, Ontario. And it's part of one of 14 regional innovation centers in the province of Ontario that helps early stage companies and evolving companies with help in a variety of areas, one of them being digital marketing. So as an executive in residence, that's my expertise. And I sit down with these early stage, a lot of times startups, where they're at in their businesses. And the startups I've been working with really have figured out the new age. They've really figured out that their web strategy right out the gate, even if they're not a B2C company, they're a B2B, has to be bang on because it'll be the future. Mm-hmm. But other companies have been around for a while. I sit down and I look at their infrastructure and I say, where are you spending money today to generate business and engage customers? And you'll look at the makeup of their organizations. There's a lot of software companies, manufacturing companies, professional services businesses where I do a lot of work. And I look at where they're spending money and where their investment is. And they are not investing in the right places in their company. And so they're overweighted in salespeople, or they're overweighted in product development, or they're overweighted in areas. And it always comes down to the CEO and the background of the CEO of how they structure the company. And so you will work with CEOs who are very salesy. And so they put a lot of time and effort into the sales team and salespeople. You'll work with CEOs who are engineers. And so all they want to focus on, and this is human nature. We gravitate to what we like to do and we want to spend time and money there. And so, what we see is, depending on where the CFO, the CEO, if they're an accountant or a CFO type, they spend all their time looking at costs and cost infrastructure.
There's no
and
so I look at CEOs. They don't do that.
Yes, I've worked with lots of those. And you sit and you look at where they're spending money, and you have to show them that there has to be a way to execute, implement, and manage. And yes, you are absolutely right. It is a full-time job.
Yeah.
And the reason it has to be a full-time job, and the reason you want to make that part of your company, is because it is the receptionist that's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Yeah. It is the first place people are going to connect with you. And if you knew that you were getting a ton of leads and connecting with even current customers through one particular path, wouldn't you spend time and money there?
And it's cheaper too. You know what I mean? Than having like five sales reps.
And this is the shift. This is the huge shift that's going on. Canada's been a little later to adopt than the US market. The content marketing has been a very big discussion in the United States for a long time. I've gone down several times to Cleveland to Content Marketing World to hear people talk. And I was so excited and started bringing back a lot of this stuff to Canada. And again, it was kind of falling on deaf ears. Now, one of the things that is an epidemic in Canada is we're great at making products, building products and services, but we're terrible at marketing them. And we continually underspend, and this is true. There's a lot of stats to support this. We continually underspend in the whole marketing area. And I've tried to dig away at this. We did our own research study last year. I've tried to dig away at this topic to figure out, is it because people don't know how to invest? Is it because they don't know what to invest in? Or is it because they've invested in the past, gotten burnt, and they don't have a framework for implementing marketing? And I tend to believe it's more the last but when you show them the framework, especially the one that we've built, they get nervous about the time and money they're going to have to spend on that. And you know, there's no silver bullet there. I tell people there is no silver bullet anymore. There might have been a glimmer of a silver bullet when Google AdWords was first taking off. You could kind of buy your way to the top in a certain keyword category, but the fickle nature of human beings is that keyword might not be the keyword of the day 3 months later, and you've spent all this time and money on it. So, you know, there's no silver bullet anymore. It's hard work.
Mm-hmm. So I could talk about this for a while, but if you're also aware of your time as well. So what I'd like to do just quickly, and I promise I won't interrupt on these, which I usually do, is do my fast five. And then I want to spend 10 minutes, just 10 minutes, talking about your book, where the idea came from, the impact you hope it has. So are you ready to play Fast Five?
Absolutely.
I have no choice. All right. Question one, what was your first job ever?
Selling Girl Guide cookies door to door.
Sorry, girl what?
Girl Guide cookies. It's your equivalent of your U.S. calls them Girl Scouts. Okay. Selling Girl Scout cookies door to door.
Which one was your favorite cookie?
The vanilla one.
Ugh, gotta go mint. All right.
Yeah, all right.
Question two. Who do you admire?
We've talked at the beginning of the podcast about my grandmother and my grandfather, big influences in my life, admired them a lot. And I admire anyone these days who attempts to write a book or even does get it out the door. I think it's an admirable, putting your thoughts down on paper and making them, it's one of our oldest, it's one of the oldest things we have. It goes right back to the Bible, the act of documenting. Mm-hmm. And so I think anybody who wants to take that on should be commended.
Yes, we'll find out if I finish that in the fall. So with your grandparents, can you give me like one specific thing that they taught you that makes them so admirable?
It taught me so many things, but my grandmother's greatest expression was, if it moves, feed it. If it doesn't, javex it. So the idea meaning if it moves, it's a human, it's an animal, you feed it, you nurture it. If it doesn't move, you just clean the heck out of it.
Awesome. Question three, what animal best represents your management style?
Oh, okay. That's a tough one. I would say a rough collie, which is a dog, and that's the Lassie dog, because always alert, always on the move to see if there's an issue. And I truly believe if someone fell down a well, meaning they weren't doing well and they were really struggling, I'm always alert to that. And I always want to get them out of the well.
I like that. It's interesting. So I've been asking that animal question for 70 interviews, maybe 80, somewhere in there. And it's kind of interesting. There's definitely a theme that comes out over time of consistency. So I kind of find that fascinating. Question four, what behaviors irritate the hell out of you, out of your colleagues?
Talking for the sake of talking and not listening.
That's the worst, isn't it?
Yeah, that one really, really bugs me.
I always hate when people do it because they want to try to be seen as the smartest person in the room, and so they over-answer a simple question.
Yes, and I have one person that I work with regularly who I love. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person. And but oftentimes uses 50 words when 3 will do. So we're working on that.
Yeah, it's a work in progress. And then a lot of that self-confidence as well for that. All right, question five. So I haven't mentioned this, but I'm on the third floor of my house. And, it's now officially triple digits every day all the way until October. And so I can't run the AC while I do these interviews. So it might be 95. I might be doing hot yoga right now, but in a podcast form. The sweat is like dripping off my head. I have my shirt 5 buttons undone, so I get some cool air somehow on the end. It's kind of hilarious. I don't know if I'd want a picture of this out, but from an entertaining standpoint. All right. Question five. What kind of situations then bring out the best in you?
I think team exercises, brainstorming, opportunities where I get to be with other people to solve a problem. And I guess if I had to, kind of create an example of that, it would be when I have my entire family over for dinner and I, that brings out the best in me, cooking for them, having everyone together, a lot of very lively conversations. And I would say those are my happiest times. And I would say that brings out the best in me.
That's awesome. I greatly appreciate it. And what I'd like to do just quickly here, because the main purpose of the podcast is for you to come and talk about your book. So can you tell me really the concept of the book, You Can't Be Everywhere, A Common Sense Approach? Can you talk to me about the idea, where it came from?
So I'm going to be very transparent and honest about the fact that I wrote this book specifically for a demographic of probably 40 to 45 plus years of age. I think there's probably stuff in this book that a millennial would look at and say, oh, that's obvious. Why did she have to write that down? And I wrote the book for a very specific demographic of people, probably what we would call solopreneurs, or people who had left a career in a big company and were now going out on their own, or starting a business, or getting to a next stage in their life. And I would get people so exhausted and frustrated with this idea of social media for business, as an example, or website for business, and just struggling, fumbling with it of, I don't know what to do. I don't know what the next step is. How do I put this all together? What should I be doing? Should I just have a LinkedIn profile? Should I be on Facebook? And I'd be getting all these questions. And then I went back to our methodology that we've been building for the last 10 years of really understanding value from the customer, the perspective, getting your value proposition right, getting data to support it, and then building in an infrastructure to test it. And I realized then that there was this thing that was coming out, and it was the fact that people just thought, because you brought it up earlier, okay, Wix is really simple and easy and out of the box, WordPress is free, I can get a Twitter account going in 30 seconds and be up and quote unquote tweeting, I can be doing all these things with online tools, there's a million tools out there, there's free email marketing software, and there's just this impression then that you can be everywhere and be doing all these things. And what I've since seen is that a lot of it's crap. It's not adding any value to your business objectives. People are just randomly doing stuff because they don't have a strategy. And so I don't think you should be everywhere. You should create a nice closed loop circuit of all of the places that you need to be online, because that's where your customers are, and because you're using it to have an honest dialogue. And I think we've all gotten very distracted by people who have 10,000 followers on Twitter, 40,000 followers on Twitter. And if you ask, well, how much revenue is that driving? It's not probably driving anything. It's getting awareness out there. Are they the right?
They may have paid for that. They may have paid for those. That's what the people don't realize.
Exactly. You know. And so the idea struck me at a conference, a content marketing world. I was sitting at a conference and I was listening to somebody speak about best practices and content development, and she sort of said, you know, and people are using all these things thinking they can be everywhere these days, and they shouldn't be. And I had been writing notes for our stuff, and it struck me like, yeah, you can't be everywhere. People think you can, but you can't, and you need to go back to the basics of good marketing, and you need to be where your customers are. And I wrote it as almost a relief statement to a certain segment of the market who was feeling overwhelmed by all of these things, having a difficult time making decisions, having a difficult time where to spend money and what to do. And so I really wrote it for them as a bit of a mantra of what I think how people should approach it, and forget all this ridiculousness. Just use some common sense and do something simple that connects with the right people at the right time.
Because, you know, I mean, it's not a big book, right? It's not a 300-page document. At least the version that I saw, so I could be wrong there. But it's a 7-chapter book that's easy to consume. And, you know, what I found that I liked is that you give just bite-sized chunks of information that are easily actionable, which is really important, right? When you're a solopreneur or entrepreneur with a small organization, is sometimes these big overwhelming, these books are written to have these big overwhelming strategies that can be quite complex for someone to sit down and kind of piecemeal their way through. So did you know, was that your intent when you wrote this, is to make sure that it's digestible for your audience?
Absolutely. And we have a lot of worksheets and resources on our website, which again, because I work so much in the small and medium sized business market, the idea was, here's a couple of things to get you started. It should not feel overwhelming. So at the beginning of the one chapter, when we talk about value proposition, we say, go get our customer scorecard, list all the people you've sold to in the last 12 months and rank them on four very basic things. How easy was it to deliver? How profitable was it? Will they refer you? And what was the cost of sale? And then look at those companies and start to find similarities that you can be using to talk about in a generic way, because the idea is that'll bring more of those types of people to you. So just a simple thing like a customer scorecard, a simple thing like writing up a buyer persona. So the idea is you do these very simply. We show you a few tips and tricks on how to get going and use them, but it's not about doing a big research assignment or, you know, yes, you should be looking at your data in Google Analytics. And, you know, a lot of people waste an incredible amount of time on social media and they don't realize they're doing it. So it's just simple things that you can turn around quite quickly. And because of the way we implement the front end of our process, we didn't want to make it feel like a textbook. We just wanted to make it feel like a conversation to give people ideas they could start with right away.
And that's the way you write it too. It's very conversational. And I appreciate that. I mean, that's the way I write. And I kind of feel like, you know, some of these really successful business books, you know, I'm blanking out on names, but there's like a handful of authors out there that take business concepts, you know, I just can't remember someone's name, but anyhow, they really boil it down to just a very simple conversational topics. Because as an audience, you know, you don't want to read a book where you have to process every sentence or every paragraph. You want to read it like you're having a dialogue. It's easier to retain. It's more entertaining, more informative from a simplicity standpoint. I don't mean that as a knock. I mean, that is that people are busy. And so when most people are probably reading this book, it's at night. And I can't speak for other people, but when I read a book at night and I'm really tired and it's complex, it's narcoleptic for me. And so,
yeah,
you know, I don't want a complex book where I get it, you know, not even probably four sentences in and I'm out for the night, which takes me 6 years to read the book eventually. So I really appreciate your approach. So can you tell my audience where they can find out more about you? The book is on Amazon. So again, reach out to You Can't Be Everywhere, A Common Sense Approach on Amazon as well. And where can they find out more about your company, Marketing Copilot?
Well, they'll give you two URLs I encourage you to look at. Marketing Copilot can be found at marketingcopilot.com, all one word. And you can also go to mariewiese.com, all one word, and see some speeches. There's some, if you want, you can get the first chapter for free from mariewiese.com of the book. You can download it for free if you want to just take a sample of what the book is about. And you can connect with us there, or you can connect with us at marketingcopilot.com, where there's a bunch of free resources available to people as part of the book.
Well, I have one final question for you, and I'll let you go because I ask everybody this question. Marie Weiss, how do you define happiness?
Well, that's pretty simple. I define happiness as the afternoon on a sunny day, sitting around having a lunch or dinner with my family and enjoying the conversation and enjoying the people I brought into the world.
Picture perfect. Marie, thank you for your time and energy and your willing to sit down with me here on Executive After Hours.
Thank you. I really appreciate you letting me do this.
Well, there you go. Marie Weiss, CEO of Marketing Copilot. She's pretty rad. Easygoing, passionate, and she had a crucible. I told you. Can you pick it out? Tweet it back at me when this comes up later this week if you can. All right. As always, leave a review wherever, whenever you can, spread the word. Have a great week, everybody. See you.